This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. In this land of sun and water, where there is no real estate, make it. That's the idea that was floated this week by the mayor of Miami-Dade County. Facing deep-pocketed protests over the idea of carving out the southwest corner of Port Miami for a soccer stadium, the mayor instead offered the option of what is currently a deep-water boat slip between the American Airlines Arena and the Perez Art Museum and what will be the Frost Museum of Art. Why such a concentration on stadium sites in downtown Miami? Back in February, when international soccer star David Beckham announced his plans to bring a Major League Soccer club to Miami, he acknowledged a pledge his supporters received.
The commissioners, the board, the mayor has promised us, I can say promised, I think, that we will be downtown. I think it's important that we... I think it's important that we are in this part of the city.
Important that in this part of the city, a pledge from leaders to be downtown. This week, Beckham was back in Miami. He and his investors have not given up on the port possibility, but it sounds like they may be considering the slip idea.
I wouldn't say it's a preferred site, but it's a very good option. Likewise with the Port of Miami.
The Port of Miami or the slip, how about it? Which would you like if a stadium is to come to downtown Miami? If it is going to be in the urban core, where should it be? If there's no downtown stadium, does that mean no pro soccer in Miami? Let us know your thoughts today on the Florida Roundup at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. You can email your comments at thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org. thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org. Send us a tweet at WLRN or go online to participate in our live online chat at wlrn.org. Sean McCann is with Curbed Miami. He joins us in studio. Derek Ham with News Service of Florida with us from Tallahassee. Let's begin local here, Sean. Is the port idea dead in the water?
No. They've got opposition from Royal Caribbean and their friends, but it's not dead in the water at all.
And is the boat slip a true alternative?
Beckham thinks it is, and Jimenez as well. Logistically, it doesn't seem big enough to me.
What seems to be the challenge here? I mean, the boat slip itself right now is a boat slip. There mm-hmm. is no land. Miami has a history of creating land where there is none, so that's not certainly out of the question. Engineering-wise, it is possible. But what are some of the other hurdles involved with creating brand new real estate where there isn't any? Downtown.
Technically, of course, none. There are transportation logistics.
How about the port idea, though? Is if the two of them are to go head-to-head from a real estate perspective at Curb Miami, which one is the better real estate play, do you think?
I think the port is more out of the way. It's gives space to Museum Park, gives space to future expansion of the downtown waterfront. One of the great things about the port, about Miami's, one of the unique aspects of Miami's port is that it's in the middle of downtown. With containerization, everybody else's ports, Port Everglades, etc., all, you know, went to the burbs. We kept our port downtown, which means that we have this awesome working waterfront, but at the same time, we have limited space for expansion. Putting a stadium on the port site would limit that further. Sure, it's vacant land now, but who knows what expansions will happen.
Well, the future will bring, certainly.
Yes.
David Beckham has made no secret that they want to fund the stadium themselves. No public funding. Derek Ham in Tallahassee, we do know that there were some ideas that were floated in terms of at least sales tax subsidies. Did those live? Did those survive the Tallahassee legislative session?
Yeah, they did, actually, and they weren't the last thing voted on this year. You know, in previous years, those stadium subsidies have been sort of died or lived in the final moments of the session. And this year, that didn't happen. It happened, you know, relatively early in the day. What did happen was the Speaker, House Speaker Will Weatherford, wanted a process by which these tax subsidies would be evaluated, right? So he said, I don't want any money. I want to change the process. I don't want to just start, you know, I don't want these people coming in here at the last minute with their hat in their hand and having to dole out taxpayer money year after year. And I want a more solid process for mm-hmm. evaluating. And so that's what passed, and some money. So the annual pool now will be $13 million. There will be a system where the DOE, the Department of Economic Opportunity, DEO, I'm sorry, will evaluate the proposals, and there will be a subsidy available to them, tiered depending on the total amount of the project.
It's a real kind of change in strategy in terms of mm-hmm. how the state wants to approach these tax givebacks for professional sports stadiums, because it sets up competition. Here's the pool of money, and that's mm-hmm. that's all there's going to be on an annual basis. And they're going to hand it out based upon certain criteria, which is much different than what has happened in the past.
Right. Then who's got the most powerful lobbyists who've contributed the most to campaigns of the leadership, and, you know, which sports teams owners come up and have a connection of and probably have contributed to, you know, X, Y, or C's
right.
campaigns. So it does suppose, you know, it's supposed to, and I hate using this cliche, but, you know, level the playing field. We heard that a lot during debate on this. So, you know, that's the purpose of it. We'll see how it shakes out. What that means for this project down there is that they could get, I think, $2 million if they, you know, the governor has said he will, by the way, sign this into mm-hmm. law. So they would be eligible for $2 million. One thing I don't know, because I haven't been following this that closely, but if there's a boat slip and they need to build land around there, wouldn't they have problems, you know, getting permitting from the Department of Environmental Protection, or is that not an issue?
Derek Hamm with the News Service of Florida, great question. Sean McCann, I don't know if you can answer that with Curb Miami, but there are certainly significant regulatory concerns.
It seems like it would be a huge issue to me. We're not creating any more new islands in the bay, because that was basically forbidden.
And look at what the hoops are that the Port Miami had to go through for the dredging of the channel itself, as well as the shoring up of the seawalls of the port.
But maybe because it's an inlet and it's not, you know, part of, I guess, the Greater Bay. That might be make it a little easier. It's also to the side of the Turning Basin, which is already commercially heavily used. I mean, how much sea life is at the bottom of that thing?
Right, but it does bring up the concern, obviously, of regulatory issues, which may delay any building of a stadium if the slip location is the final location. Derek Hamm, though, who else is in the pool? Who else is in the running for some of this money? It's not just the MLS Beckham Group for Miami. I mean, there's a number of other organizations.
That's right. There would be the there's the it would be Major League Baseball. You know, of course you.
Well, it's
Major League Baseball, and the Daytona Speedway, I think, is sort of the big the big gun in the big, what do you call it, the elephant in the room or whatever. But they would be the one that
the
would
semi
be
semi in the room.
Yeah, they are. It would be them, and I don't know if the Dolphins stadium. It would be there. There's they added Minor League Baseball, I think. I'm sorry. I'm looking it up right now while we're talking.
The idea here, though, that I wanted to get to is that it is some pretty significant competition, and it's throughout the entire state of Florida. And as you mentioned, the Daytona Speedway with NASCAR is the perhaps the most established sports venue in the state of Florida that could be in the pool for this money to compete for the limited amount of state dollars in terms of sales tax rebates that the state legislature approved for professional stadiums in the state of Florida. It's no longer the case where it is favoritism based upon the power of a legislator or a regional slate of legislators. Instead, it is trying to put more economic development, a little bit more of a economic strategy involved in the pool of money, and limit the kind of taxpayer involvement with these professional sports stadiums after the situation with the Marlins here, after the situation, the failed situation that the Dolphins and Sun Life had during the last legislative session.
Right. It would be Major League Soccer, the North American Soccer League, NASCAR. Okay, this is funny. The Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association, hosts of the Breeders' Cup horse races and minor league baseball facilities. So
there you go. Between the rodeo and the cowboys, the soccer players, minor league baseball, and of course the race car drivers with NASCAR. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. You can join the conversation at 800-743-9576. Steve joins the program from Palmetto Bay. Steve, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. When I was a kid, the area just north of what's now the American Airlines Arena was where the docks were prior to the creation of Dodge Island. And prior to that, there were two inlets like that would have been cut into the land for use as a Navy submarine base during World War II. So I'm pretty sure that we could fill those back in because they're not natural features without there being that big of a problem. I don't think that DERM or any sort of environmental prohibitions would allow us to return what was once there. So,
Steve,
I think they can put it there, but whether that's politically the wise thing to do is another question.
It's another thing altogether. Yeah, Steve from Palmetto Bay there, a little history lesson on the waterfront in downtown Miami. Sean McCann with Curbed Miami, the regulatory concerns may be addressed, ownership concerns may be addressed, but again, location, location, location. From a real estate perspective, which one do you think is going to be the spark for additional development? It's not just the stadium involved here in terms of what the community needs to look at. That's a big part of it, there's no doubt, but it is the associated development that can happen in a neighborhood or may not happen in a neighborhood if the stadium is locked in.
Well, he's right. That was Miami's first port. That's Biscayne Boulevard, went along the port, went along the various wharves. And Dodge Island came along and the port moved there. But I think Watson Island would be much better than either of these two scenarios.
Watson Island. This is the island with Jungle Island and with the Children's Museum, and is one of the egresses for the new Port Miami Tunnel, which will open up later this month. That is not being actively discussed.
No, but it really should be.
Why?
I don't know. It's not, but it really should be because...
But why do you think Watson Island should be a location that ought to be on this list? It wasn't on the short list.
Because there's great transportation access with the MacArthur Causeway, because there's talk of adding Baylink connection to Miami and Miami Beach, because the real estate is there, because the Island Gardens mega project that was, it's been planned to go there for the last 13 years is on its last legs.
This was a project on the southwest part of what is Watson Island, across,
and it's still technically supposed to, and I'm making air quotes, which you can't see, supposed to be happening.
But you talk about transportation there. It's going to see a lot more transportation when the port tunnel opens up. There is no current public transportation in terms of anything beyond just a normal bus route compared to downtown Miami, which has the Metrolink, which is a couple of stops away from Metro Rail, which arguably could have better public transportation and public access to it.
Well, as public transit currently is, I don't think, and if we kept it as it currently is, I don't think very many people would take Metro Rail to a soccer game. However, if Baylink was added, if you could get straight from South Beach to the stadium, by rail, I think many people would take that option.
Yeah. Lots of ifs, though, in that option at this point. Lots of big ifs.
I got to tell you one thing that isn't an if, and that is David Beckham's popularity in Tallahassee. Because he came up here, and I was one of the lucky reporters who got to go and sit down and have a little press thing with him. And
I wasn't invited.
I'm sorry. He was very charming, he shook every one of our hands, and... The Twitter, I think, almost shut down because all the lawmakers were doing selfies with David Beckham, and it was quite, he's quite charming, and they really like him.
I don't think there's any question about the success of the charm offensive of the Beckham group. I think there's plenty of questions regarding the location success of building a soccer stadium in downtown Miami. Dara Kam with News Service of Florida, Sean McCann with Curbed Miami. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Stick with us. Still to come, the unfinished business after state lawmakers leave Tallahassee, and could we see the green shoots of a legal marijuana growing industry in Florida? Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. There was really very little dust kicked up during the two-month legislative session that ended 1 week ago today in Tallahassee. Instead of loads of partisanship, backbiting, and brinkmanship, it was really more compromise, congeniality, and surprisingly, arguably, progressive policies, especially regarding undocumented students and medical marijuana. Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN, joining us on the Florida Roundup. Derek Hamm with News Service of Florida, still with us from Tallahassee. And you can join the conversation at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or on Twitter, use the call sign at WLRN. Derek, first of all, gambling was one of the big issues that was not significantly addressed. Why not?
Well, the deal sort of fell apart at the midway during the session because any prospect of passing significant legislation fell apart because the House Speaker, Will Weatherford, set out two very high criteria that needed to be met in order for his chamber to pass anything. The first was he wanted the governor to complete negotiations with the Seminole tribe mm-hmm. regarding a compact portion of the compact that's going to sunset next year regarding the banked card games. And he wanted a constitutional amendment, and that was a little bit confusing for us following that, but that would give voters, that would allow voters to decide in November whether they would decide in the future on any expansion of gambling. So that really sort of put the ixnay on the gambling thing pretty early on. At the end of session, a couple of weeks before, you know, I think the week before the last week, the governors sent out Lieutenant Governor Carlos Lopez Quintera and some of his other high-ranking staffers to meet with legislative leaders in both chambers to discuss the possibility of a special session in mid-May regarding the compact. But they didn't give them enough details about what was in it, and what they did hear was in it was too friendly for the Seminoles, and so yeah. That's off track.
It was the last day of session. It was Friday a week ago when word started floating out of the governor's office that they're close to having a deal, wrapping up a deal with the Seminoles regarding the banked card games, blackjack,
right.
And whatnot.
It was a week before the last day.
And so what has happened with those negotiations? Have they stalled since then? I mean, Governor Scott seems that he certainly seems like he would like to have those negotiations wrapped up and a new compact signed to run on in the election cycle.
Sure, because who signed the first compact? Charlie Crist.
Governor Crist,
and who can
right.
campaign? And who can say, I got a better deal than Charlie Crist? You know, it would be nice, I guess, if the governor thinks it would be nice to do that. What I have heard from my sources in the close to the governor's office and close to this gambling deal is that they have backed away from it and they aren't planning on doing anything before the election. It was an embarrassment for them.
In the meantime, of course, voters will decide the future to some degree of medical marijuana in the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. Tim Padgett also covering this, especially from a Latin American perspective, Uruguay being the country mm-hmm. that has moved forward on legalization. Were there surprises for you as you look at this legislative session at Tallahassee regarding a limited but yet vocal embracing of specific strains of medical marijuana?
No, because as we've seen with polls in the past couple of years, there is strong support in Florida for legalizing medical marijuana. And what you're seeing now even is this medical marijuana industry now that is just poised to explode here. I mean, as a journalist, my inbox and my email inbox has been filling up with PR releases from new companies that are just coming out of the woodwork. I got one yesterday from a firm that calls itself the Florida Medical Marijuana Treatment Center Institute that is going to be offering its services, and it's just one of many. You've got estimates now that the potential market size for the medical marijuana industry in the state could be as between $140 million and as high as $5 billion annually. I mean, these numbers could be, you know, outrageous exaggerations.
But dartboard forecasting.
This is what's coming out now,
yeah.
and that sales tax revenues could be as high as $340 million annually.
Certainly, there is an economic opportunity here for the state. Derek Hamm with News Service of Florida. you know, 6 weeks ago, it was a very limited strain of marijuana extract to be given to children who are suffering from a specific kind of epilepsy. But in the final days, the legislature was able to expand the use of this Charlotte's Web, wasn't it?
Well, they did. They still, Charlotte's Web is one version or one strain of this low THC, high CBD. The THC is the stuff that gets you high in pot. And so it has to be what they approved, a strain of what they call, some people are calling it non-euphoric. There's a question about how low you have to go to not get high from it. So I call it low THC. And they expand, but what they did to expand it was they expanded the population of patients who would be eligible to have their doctor order this for it. So it wasn't, it isn't no longer just this 150,000 kids with this severe form of epilepsy. It is also now cancer patients and anyone with severe muscle spasms or chronic seizures. So I have not been able to get from the Department of Health yet exactly how many people in Florida would be deemed eligible to, you know, fit those criteria. But it's much larger than what we originally were thinking the legislature was going to sign off on. What they think they've done, what the Republican legislature seems to have done, is to approve something that doesn't get you high, that isn't going to allow, you know, two guys on the to open up a pot dispensary on the corner, and yet is going to treat people who are, you know, critically ill. And so it shows some compassion for this issue that the most recent poll that I wrote about showed 88% support for in Florida.
Yeah, so the Republican legislature approves of this. The Republican governor, Dara, likely to sign it?
Oh, yes. He said he would sign it. Okay. He has said he would sign it.
So there's compassion here. But to, you know, Tim talked about the commerce opportunities that marijuana supporters are already pointing to. And there is a cultivation regulation buried inside the legislation that the Republican legislators approved of this year. Cultivation, growing of marijuana. Tell us about this. Is this setting the infrastructure up for broader medical distribution and growth in the state of Florida?
Absolutely. The vertical integration system that they have authorized in this bill, which means that the grower has to also be the one who manufactures this paste or oil and also be the distributor, is the same exact distribution model, integration model, that is included in the constitutional amendment that's on the November ballot. So what a lot of people are thinking, and they've restricted it, the legislature restricted it to nurseries that have been registered in Florida for 30 years and are presently producing 400,000 or more plants. The list of that is right now 21. I spoke with the Department of Agriculture folks this morning, and they said they think there might be more people, that nurseries that might be on that list. But I had a story out yesterday. There are folks from out of state who are doing partnerships to try to come in and hook up with these guys because they want to get an early foot in the door. They're not so concerned about Charlotte's Web. Come on, let's face it. They were honest about it. They want this much broader market, this, you know what, gazintagillion, let's call it, dollar market that might open up after November.
Right. I mean, Tim, if the voters in Florida approve of the broader medicinal use of marijuana, that's why your inbox is getting filled up with all of these pitches of marijuana businesses.
But it's a balancing act because on the one hand, you do have this huge market out there that everybody wants to tap, but by the same time, they want to be politically savvy and realize that what sells also is regulations, giving this appearance that this is well regulated and controlled.
Governor Scott has signaled his desire to sign this limited portion into law. The likely Democratic candidate come November for the gubernatorial election, Governor Crist. Tim, you've covered Governor Crist throughout the years. Where do we know where he stands on these issues?
I believe he supports the medical marijuana as well, and any Democratic candidate at this point, seeing the poll numbers, would not be for it.
Yeah. Meantime, we did see some headlines this week that former Governor Crist reportedly may be considering considering a visit to Cuba during the governor's campaign. What have we learned from the governor's staff of how real this possibility may be?
Well, all his campaign staff will acknowledge that it is something they are talking about. Whether it's something that he would do as a candidate or just as a candidate, or whether he would actually do it if he were to become governor, that's another question that really hasn't been answered. What we do know is that there is a risk here politically for him.
Yeah.
He has come out and said that he is against he is for dismantling the embargo, for example, against Cuba, because he realizes that poll numbers here, even amongst Cuban Americans, show that they want that as well. But as you well know, Tom, there's a difference between poll math and voter math.
Yeah.
And even though the polls may show that even Cuban Americans are for getting rid of the Cuban embargo, that doesn't always translate into what happens in the voter booth. And Governor Crist really needs to be careful, I think, at this point to not go too far in alienating conservative Latinos in Florida, because that could backfire on him.
There's also... Well, go ahead, Dara.
Yeah, the calculus, though, there is that these conservative Cuban Americans aren't going to vote for him anyway. And what Crist is reaching out for is this new generation of Cuban Americans, these South American Hispanics, Puerto Rican Hispanics, who have very different views about the embargo on Cuba and Hispanic relations and Cuban relations than do the old school, hardline Cubans in the Miami and Tampa Bay area. That's you better believe that Governor Crist and his folks are pulling the hell out of this before he, goes in anywhere near Cuba. But clearly, there's something that shows that this is an advantage to him, or he wouldn't be talking about it.
Right, but I think he's also testing the waters, which Charlie is very good at doing.
Mm-hmm.
At this point. And I think one of the questions he and his campaign have to ask themselves is how many convenient political sound bites do you want to keep handing the Rick Scott campaign? Mm-hmm. One of the benefits that the campaign got out of this news this week about him possibly wanting to visit Cuba is that it allowed Scott's Cuban-American lieutenant governor to issue a sound bite the likes of which was, Charlie was first a Republican, now he's a Democrat. It seems now he wants to become a communist. Whatever you think about a soundbite like that, it tends to get traction.
Mm-hmm.
And to what extent does Charlie want to keep giving the Scott campaign that kind of traction?
Well, politics, at least in Tallahassee, dying down, beginning to heat up in the governor's race here in Florida. Panamanians, meantime, went to the polls and elected a new president as well. Vice President Juan Carlos Varela's victory was a bit of a surprise in Panama in the past week.
Those who supported me and those who did not support me must know that from this moment on we are one country, we are one people. Let's take down the party flags and govern with the flag of Panama for all Panamanians.
Well, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the Panama Canal, and that's the big main driver for that country's economy. Panama is nearing the completion of a $5 billion expansion due to be completed late next year. Not everyone, though, benefits from the trade and investments going through the canal. Cologne sits on the canal's Caribbean entrance. Unemployment there, 50%. Roberto Darkins sells clothing on the city's main street, his own brand, and he says Panama's building boom has made housing less affordable for families like his. And his family includes his wife and four children. They all share a one-bedroom apartment on the eighth floor of a decaying 19th-century building.
You make a building and you charge $500, $700 a month. And the salary here is like $200, $300 a month. Who you expect to go and live in those buildings?
Tim Padgett was traveling in Panama ahead of the Panamanian presidential election. Much of a surprise with the vice president victory?
It was an upset.
Yeah.
Juan Carlos Varela had been at one point aligned with current President Ricardo Martinelli, broke with him. And I think the main reason he ended up winning in the end was because he ran on an anti-corruption platform. And I think that resonated a lot with Panamanians, especially because there was this feeling that President Martinelli, a very conservative politician, that he may have been trying to do an end run around the Constitution. Panamanian presidents are barred from holding consecutive terms in office. But yet there was this feeling that because he had installed his wife as the vice presidential candidate on his party's ticket, he was perhaps trying to circumvent that rule.
But yet it was his number two, the vice president, running on an anti-corruption campaign, even though he was the number two in the office. Did he not shoulder any responsibility for the corruption that he was running against?
No, he says, I mean, what he was able to convince Panamanian voters of, obviously, was that he was not really a part of that. And that's why he did break with President Martinelli.
And what were the policies that he put forth, or the ideas, the hopes, the desires that he put forth in terms of combating the corruption?
Well, I think he was able to convey the message to Panamanians that, look, we are making a slew of money. No economy in Latin America right now is growing as fast as Panama's, despite the fact that it only has a population of 3.5 million people. And what's driving that is the canal, and especially the coming expansion of the canal. But here's the catch. Panama has one of the most notoriously corrupt political systems in the hemisphere, and that tends to drain a lot of that wealth off to a political and economic elite, which is why you still have 40% poverty rate in Panama, and one of the widest gaps between rich and poor in the Americas. And so it was very savvy of him to run on an anti-corruption platform, because that really did convince Panamanians that perhaps he'll be able to use the canal wealth to start narrowing that gap between rich and poor, and at the same time help the country reach this goal of becoming what the Hong Kong of the Americas, a global maritime and financial hub.
Because it's not just transversing the continents, cutting through the continents that Panama wants to do. It not only wants the ships to go through, it wants to be able to be a conduit for financial services, because that's where the big margin is. That's where the big commerce opportunity
is. It's all about logistics, and that's what makes this tiny country so important in the Americas right now.
What about the diplomatic relations with this new president in the United States?
Oh, I think it'll be good, because the U.S. State Department for years now has been complaining about the corruption in Panama, particularly in the judicial system, which makes it hard for businesses to feel that their investments are safe there.
I have to stay in Latin America and a little bit of diplomacy with Venezuela. It was back on the agenda just yesterday in front of a U.S. Senate committee. And there seems to be growing pressure onto the Obama White House to try to turn up the heat in Venezuela with some of the problems and the civil rights issues that are happening.
Right. Even Democrats on Capitol Hill right now are urging the Obama administration to levy some kind of sanctions on President Nicolas Maduro's socialist government in Venezuela, especially because of the human rights abuses that his security forces have committed during the anti-government protests. The Obama administration has been balking because they don't want this conflict to become a U.S. versus Maduro clash, which would only serve Maduro's interests. But the problem is that when you have a large growing Venezuelan constituency living here in the U.S. as we do now, it becomes hard not to not to listen to that constituency's demands for sanctions.
The sanctions that have been used so far have been highly targeted sanctions after really a handful of people, a handful of Venezuelan officials that have been, coming out of Venezuela and perhaps bringing their capital with them.
Right.
Is there democratic support building for broader sanctions? And of course, the pushback is you're going to hurt those that they're designed to protect.
Right. No, I think what even Democrats are pushing for is just a broadening of levying sanctions against at least high-level Venezuelan government officials, freezing their visas access, for example, freezing their assets that they might have here. Russian-style sanctions, for example, like we're seeing right now against the Putin government. That's what they want to see more of, just to show that the government is responding in some way to what's going on in Venezuela.
And this is a big part of Florida politics, certainly, on the national level, no doubt about it. Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLRN. Derek Hamm with News Service of Florida. Stick with us, Derek. Coming up still on the Florida Roundup, Broward County Public Schools want to borrow $800 million. For what? Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. One former board member was sent to prison for public corruption. A second accused of corruption, a state grand jury called evidence of gross mismanagement and apparent ineptitude, quote, so overwhelming that we cannot imagine any level of incompetence that would explain what we've seen, end quote. In Broward County, that was your school board. That was between 2009 and 2011. This week, the board began a process that will end with asking voters in November for a permission to borrow $800 million, a big bond referendum in Broward County. Has the board and district management been cleaned up? What's the case for why this money is necessary for Broward County Public Schools? And after so many problems, can the board be trusted? Let us know at 800-743-WLRN. Do you support having Broward County borrow almost $1 billion for schools? 1-800-743-9576. Scott Travis with the Sun Sentinel is along with us. Derek Hamm with News Service of Florida still with us from Tallahassee. Scott, let's start here in South Florida. How is the Broward School Board trying to win back voter trust as it goes for this $800 million bond referendum?
Well, I think that the school board's position is that all those problems that you saw were of a different era. They were a different school board, a different superintendent, different top administrators. We're the folks who have been elected or appointed to come in and clean this up. We've done a good job, haven't had any major scandals, any financial scandals in the last couple of years. We have done a pretty good job of doing what the independent auditors and the state has recommended that we do. So we feel like we're back on track, but the state has made a lot of cutbacks,
right,
and that's made it very difficult to do a lot of the needed school renovations, repairs of facilities, and things like that.
And, Dara, I want to ask you about education funding that came out of this legislative session. But Scott Travis with the Sun Sentinel, this money that Broward County wants to borrow, the school district wants to borrow, is it all for essentially repairs, building repairs?
That would probably be the bulk of it. I think they want to use about 5 to 10%, which would be for technology.
Okay.
So they believe that their computers, a lot of them are outdated. And I remember even interviewing a teacher a few months ago who was saying they were still using cassette tapes in their classroom. So I think they definitely have some issues in some schools. I mean, some schools have iPads and the newest stuff, but there's still a lot of issues where they're using computers from the 90s. And technology that just isn't up to date. So
yeah,
that would be the other piece of it. But the largest piece would be about facilities needs. It's not about building new schools like it has been in the
past.
It's
about repairing roofs and windows and doors and those kinds of things. So ceiling tiles, floor tiles, those, right?
Right, yeah. Kind of seeing what the deficits are, what the problems are with the existing schools and trying to bring them up to modern standards.
Scott, I do want to ask you about any kind of assurances that the board is putting into regulations or otherwise regarding handling of the constructions and the bids, because the corruption that came and was uncovered in 2009, 10, and 11 really came with contractors. So, you know, has the board changed contracting policies?
Yeah, they've done a number of things. They've changed the process and the way that they do bids and how they can collect on from contractors. And they've done some nepotism policies and made sure that you're not allowed to do business with your brother and mm-hmm. things like that to try to ensure that that they do not have the problems that they've had in the past. But there are still issues. Just at the school board meeting a couple of days ago, they were complaining about change orders that seemed to be a big issue in the with contracts, that there's a certain price that's agreed upon, and then they keep coming back needing more money because something has changed that
gotcha.
Wasn't seen the first time.
Dara, I want to ask you here, as the legislative session wrapped up, it was a record amount of money geared toward K-12 education in the state of Florida, but, you know, counties like Broward, the sixth largest school district in the nation, are, you know, trying to make up for perhaps deferred maintenance or missed maintenance because of those years of budget cutbacks.
Right, and actually the per pupil,
per pupil spending around $6,700, something like that?
Went down. It is actually about $190 less than it was at the peak of per student spending back in the earlier 2000. So, you know, there's been quite, a lot of debate about whether they're actually spending more money or not. And then we did see a lot of money. There was a lot of talk about charter schools this mm-hmm. year. I don't know if we want to get into that. So the states, the counties are still, it's interesting that, you know, the change orders things, and that I heard in the beginning, you know, it's the state's fault because the state's not spending as much money. And then it's the property taxes' fault because the, you know, there's so many foreclosures and the property values are going down. So it's always somebody's fault. But I think that I grew up in Broward County, and I was unaware of all this stuff that was going on down there.
Yeah, well, we'll see if Broward County voters are going to support the schools with an $800 million bond referendum. It's a lot of money, there's no doubt, and we'll see the case that the school board makes for that between now and November. Scott Travis covering it for the Sun Sentinel, and Derek Hamm with News Service of Florida. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN.
You wonder if Jimbo would go ahead and run it. He's put Winston up under center. No, throw it. End zone, jump ball, touchdown. You know who he went for, number one.
Brent Musburger calling the touchdown that put Florida State over the top against Auburn to win the BCS Bowl in January, led by quarterback James Winston. Winston was the subject of a rape investigation late last year. He was cleared of criminal charges, but the woman who made the original accusation has since filed a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights. FSU is one of 55 colleges and universities on a Department of Education list under investigation for possible federal law violations over handling the handling of sexual assault cases. FSU is the only Florida school on the list. Parents, any second thoughts about sending your child to Florida State? How about from alums? Let's hear from you. Any concerns about donating to your alma mater as the school is under investigation by the Department of Education? 1-800-743-9576. Here on the Florida Roundup, we're at 1-800-743-WLRN. Matt Baker joins us from the Tampa Bay Times. You were the first reporter to contact the Tallahassee Police Department about the original case that has led to FSU on this Department of Education investigative list. Any explanation for the school's delay in resolving the complaint, Matt?
Yeah, there's been a couple. One is they've said that they didn't realize Jameis Winston was a suspect in this case until November of 2013. Your timeline is that this incident happened, whatever happened, was done on December 7th of 2012. So they didn't realize that Jameis was, you know, the possible assailant until 11 months later.
And why was that? Was it a lack of communication with the legal authorities?
That's one theory. FSU police knew about it on, again, December 7th, 2012. They were the first authorities to respond to it. Then, according to emails we've read and received from Tallahassee police, in January of 2013, just after Jameis was identified as a suspect, an athletic director assistant, it's not named in the emails, but contacted Tallahassee police about the case to figure out what happened. But at some point in that, it didn't get pushed up the chain, or if it did get pushed up the chain of commands to the people who could do something about it, it wasn't really investigated. And then that leads to the other issue as to why it might not have been investigated.
Right.
It's a tough balancing act that schools have, and this is what FSU has said a couple different times, between what a woman wants if she said she's been assaulted and what the school must do. If the girl doesn't want to cooperate, this is too personal a matter, I don't want to talk about it. I want to talk about it with my counselor, and that's it. What the Department of Education requires for a school to do to investigate if there's a perpetrator to punish him, it's kind of murky on what they do. So FSU has said repeatedly that they've been in compliance. I'm still looking for answers about what they did to investigate and what they knew when.
Well, we reached out to FSU, Matt. The school declined to participate in our live discussion here on the Florida Roundup, but did provide a comment which reads in part, universities are in a frustrating catch-22. State and federal student privacy laws prohibit them from discussing any individual case, but this puts them at risk of the media or the public assuming the silence is a lack of concern for conducting sexual assault investigations. Further on in this comment that FSU provided to WLRN, it says, quote, the university must perform a balancing act between the need to conduct investigations and the need to honor the wishes of the victim who may not want to proceed, end quote. Just part of the statement that FSU sent to us. Matt, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, the last part is very interesting and very important. I've talked to a lot of people about Title IX and what its responsibilities are. There's three different Department of Education guidelines you can look at. 2001, there was a guidance that they sent to schools about what to do with sexual assault and sexual harassment. In 2011, in April 2011, it was a Dear Colleague letter that they sent to kind of help explain what they wanted to do. And then just a week or two ago, the Department of Education sent another one that's like a 56-page Q&A with some of the guidelines. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not too smart a guy. I still have no idea about some of the guidelines and what they actually mean in English, because every case is so different. If you've got a bad guy on campus, you want to get him off campus. I think everyone would agree with that. But where does what the girl wants come into things on how what information is shared? Then you've got federal privacy laws to deal with. Here in Florida, only the victim's advocate isn't supposed to share any information to anyone at the university other than with the girl. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole bunch of layers to this that makes it a very complex case. And that's why, like you said, 55 schools across the country are dealing with
it. Well, there's also due process obviously involved, especially when there's criminal issues at stake here. Derek Hamm with the News Service of Florida, you're in Tallahassee. Did this catch any attention on the part of legislators, certainly when Tallahassee honored FSU?
Well, it was strange because people were not really talking about it. One of the most powerful out loud, and really this New York Times investigative piece that is really chilling and very well done. I highly encourage anyone who's interested in this to check out the piece by Walt Bogdanich on it's like you don't know who's more at fault in this situation. So no, they weren't talking about it out loud. There was a lot of honoring of FSU, and there's a chatter about one of the most powerful state senators, John Thrasher, possibly heading up the university. He was a former chairman of the Republican Party of Florida. Yeah. But no, this isn't the kind of thing they want to talk about. I will say that on the one hand, that this victim apparently, was quite frustrated because she kept calling the police trying to find out, or her, representatives for her
attorney, yeah,
trying to find out what the status of this case was. So this is not a woman who, whispered this into a friend's ear and then disappeared.
Yeah, well, there's lots of questions on how the criminal investigation even proceeded, Matt. Concerns about, evidence and timing between allegations made and investigators following up on those allegations and asking questions. But what's the status of the Department of Education investigation into FSU and these 54 other schools?
It's going to take a while, I think, is the bottom line. They opened the case a couple weeks ago now, and they're looking at it. They're looking at this particular case with Winston. They've also requested information about, other similarly situated students.
Do we know how many other cases possibly the DOE is looking at? At FSU?
It's hard to tell because obviously this isn't the only case that, sexual assault that FSU has dealt with, and that's nothing against FSU, but sexual assault is a major issue on every campus across the country, even the ones in Florida that weren't mentioned in this. So, and this is, like I said, it's going to take a while. A similar case, it was in Missoula, Montana, a big football power in the lower levels, that they started an investigation in May of 2012 and finally resolved it to some degree in May of 2013. So I think this investigation from the Department of Education and the Office for Civil Rights will take months, maybe a year, maybe two. Mm. Then after that, it's going to be all of the civil cases. I still expect the girl, the woman in this case, to sue probably Tallahassee police, probably Florida State, probably Winston as well. So this is something that we're going to be dealing with for a long time.
Matt Baker.
What's the possible penalty for the university from the Department of Education? Is there any?
They can do some steps to kind of correct whatever was done wrong and hopefully fix it so it doesn't happen again. But the real only stick that they have is withdrawing federal funding. It's never been done.
Is that a real threat in this case?
I wouldn't think so because it's never happened before. I think there'd have to be something very egregious. But the way this works is it's a quid pro quo. FSU agrees to take federal funding. In doing so, they agree to abide by these standards and these rules against sexual discrimination and harassment and that sort of thing.
We've got to leave it there. Matt Baker with the Tampa Bay Times, along with us, Derek Hamm with News Service of Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup, produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our executive producer at WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.